We continue our studies in Mark's Gospel, and we read in Mark chapter 12 and from the 13th verse. Mark chapter 12 and reading from verse 13. You will remember that these events take place during the last week of our Lord's public ministry. He had entered Jerusalem. He had driven the money changers out of the temple. He had been questioned by the religious leaders. They had questioned his authority for behaving in this way. Jesus had taught that very instructive parable of the tenants, indicating not only that he knew they were about to kill him, but that he knew that in their heart of hearts, they did not want God's rule in their lives. And on this particular day, which has become known as the Day of Questions, the religious leaders sent wave upon wave of questioners to Jesus to try to trip him, to trick him, to trap him. They were determined to bring Jesus down, and the passage before us is illustrative of that. Verse 13. Later, they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, "Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we?" But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. "Why are you trying to trap me?" he asked. "Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." They brought the coin. And he asked them, "Whose portrait is this? And whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then Jesus said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar, and to God what is God." And they were amazed at him. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this public reading of his holy word. Now turn with me, please, to the passage we read earlier in Mark's Gospel. I wonder, have you a favorite TV cartoon character? I think that mine must be Roadrunner, you know, that American fowl, constantly chased by a coyote whose great ambition in life seems to be to catch him in one of his elaborate traps. And of course, the coyote's plans constantly backfire on him. And he is invariably the victim of his very own traps. Now, that cartoon teaches a profound truth. When we set out to trap other people, we often fall victim of our own traps. And this was certainly the experience of the religious leaders in the passage before us. They set out to trap Jesus on what we've described as the Day of Questions. And they lay trap after trap after trap for Jesus. But in each case, they become embarrassingly, frustratingly entangled in their own traps. as plans go, this plan in verse 13 following must have struck the religious leaders as ingenious. A number of Pharisees and Herodians were sent to Jesus in order to create the impression that these two parties were having an argument. And the point at issue was whether we should pay taxes to Caesar or not. Now, the Pharisees were the Jewish nationalists. They absolutely hated and detested Roman rule. It was a source of acute humiliation to them. In contrast, the Herodians were the Roman lapdogs, constantly on the lookout for ways in which they might profit from their relationship with Rome. Indeed, Herod himself was on the throne because of his fawning loyalty to the Roman emperor. How plausible this trap must have seemed as two groups of sworn enemies come to Jesus for his judgment. But Jesus was only too well aware that their common hatred for him far outstripped their hatred for one another. You know, hatred can bring the most unlikely groups of people together. And a common hatred of God and for his grace does that more surely than anything else in all of the world. C.S. Lewis comments on this phenomenon. He writes, "The whole kingdom of darkness is plagued with disharmony, and it is only its mutual hatred of God which gives it any semblance of coherence." Mutual hatred of God that gives it any semblance of coherence. Hatred of Jesus and opposition to him can produce strange bedfellows, as Herod and Pilate were to demonstrate later that week. But this phenomenon is not rooted in the first century. In every age, and in the experience of every Christian, the time comes when those who have nothing else in common and who are often widely noted for their great dislike the one for the other will nevertheless bind themselves together against Christ and his gospel and his people. Why is that? The struggle for the survival of self centered living makes sure of that. You will remember that the basic thrust of the parable of the vineyard was to expose man's self-centeredness and rejection of God's rule. It is this desire for self-centered living that can bind together the most unlikely of individuals against God and his grace. The greatest superglue known to man is a common hatred of Jesus. Now, the method of approach made in verse 14 to Jesus was certainly calculated to put him off guard. You will notice that they flatter him. "Teacher, we know you're a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. They flatter him. Now, flattery does not necessarily involve exaggeration or untruthfulness. It can speak the truth, as in these verses. Jesus was noted for his integrity, his impartiality, his fearlessness, his teaching ability. He was qualified above all others to provide an objective judgment. If flattery, however, is ever to succeed, it must proceed on the basis of truth. Imagine a small boy coming to his older sister, whose appearance is plain and complexion is spotty. And he tells her that she looks as stunning as any actress he has seen in television or in the films. And can you please advance me some money until I get my pocket money? Now, he has laid things on so thickly that she sees through his scheme. But if he tells her she has a much more attractive personality than many of her friends, and that in his view personality counts much, much more than good looks, then he has a better chance of securing the loan. Flattery is praise insincerely given for an interested purpose. And the purpose of these men was entrapment. The word that's used here is a hunting term. And it's used to describe the way in which a hunter will camouflage himself in order not to alert his victim. But Jesus sees through the camouflage. He sees all of the way into men's hearts. He knows the real reason for their professed interest in him. It's very sobering, you know, to think. We may fool our family. We may fool our friends, our workmates, our minister, other church members. But we cannot fool God concerning our professed interest in him. Our hearts are an open book to Jesus. I'm sure the chief priests and the religious leaders must have given themselves a pat on the back. I'm sure if they had any, the champagne was on ice, waiting for the great celebration. Had they not placed Jesus on the horns of an inescapable dilemma? If Jesus had answered, yes, pay taxes to Caesar, he would have lost all of his popular support. On the other hand, if he had discouraged payment, they could have accused him of being a traitor, instigating sedition against Rome. Jesus was in a no-win situation, or so they thought. Time and again, Christians can find themselves pursued by questioners whose sole aim is to trap them and to show their Christianity up in a bad light. Sometimes the questions are asked by people who are intellectually superior and know it. I believe we need to learn from this passage and see how Jesus dealt with the trap. You will notice that Jesus asked for a coin. You can sense the drama of the occasion. The coin was brought and it bore the emperor's head, his portrait and inscription. Now, in the ancient world, coinage was a sign of power. The first task of any conqueror was to strike his own coinage. And those who used the coin acknowledged the ruler's power. And Jesus was saying to his questioners, who obviously had such coins in their possession, by using the coinage of Tiberius Caesar, you are recognizing his political power in Palestine. But Jesus' argument runs deeper even than that. By using the coin, they were acknowledging the many privileges which Tiberius's reign had brought them. The benefit to commerce, the growth of the infrastructure, including the construction of Roman roads, trouble-free borders. They were able to travel in safety and in peace, and so on. Jesus was saying, you can't expect to enjoy the privileges of Roman rule and yet shrink from your responsibility towards that rule. Now, the very word they use in verse 15 for pay refers to a grudging handing over of something that has been imposed. But in his reply, in verse 17, Jesus uses another word, the word translated as give, a word that speaks of paying back a rightful debt, a word that speaks of something given with gratitude and not with resentment. Now, I have no brief this morning from the Inland Revenue, but Jesus' teaching here does have tremendous practical implications for the Christian's attitude towards the state. Today, a great many people consider that it is a feather in their cap if they can pull one over on the taxman or the social service department, or if they can fool the customs officers when they return from their holiday overseas. A great many people do resent paying taxes to the state. We want all of the benefits of local and central government, often without paying for them. And our society does have benefits by the barrelload in comparison to many third world countries. We may complain about the health service and the prescription charges that are up yet again. We may complain about the education in our schools, about the infrastructure and the poor roads and the transport system, about the process of law in the courts. We may have some reservations about the quality of some of these services, and perhaps even legitimately so. But you see, the point that Jesus is making here is, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. That is, you cannot hold out your hand to the state and say, we want all of the benefits that you can provide us with, while closing our hands and saying, we do not want to be held accountable for paying in any way towards that provision. But notice, Jesus does not let the matter rest there. Just when these men thought they could mischievously use Jesus' words, he added, and give to God the things that are God's. It was as though Jesus is saying, there is another coin that I see before me, and it bears a different image. The image of God is stamped upon the lives of every single individual man and woman. And his image also reminds me of a power and authority that each individual is answerable to. And Jesus is saying, you must not forget to give him what is his. And that is the whole of your lives. Jesus here, in fact, has placed the question of living under Caesar in its proper place. It comes a distant second behind something infinitely more important. Living under God's rule. Now, this reply of Jesus causes us to see the state and our obedience to it in its proper context. The state has certain legitimate demands which it can rightly make upon us. But there are nevertheless boundaries over which it dare not pass. Now, in later years, some of the Roman emperors got too big for their boots, and they demanded of men and women what they had no right to demand. That is, that they themselves be worshipped as gods. Indeed, it was the practical outworking of the Christian faith in the early centuries which made so many Roman emperors jittery towards it, for they discovered that the Christian population was by and large a peaceful and law-abiding population. But in refusing to worship the emperor as he required, they were acknowledging that they had a loyalty to one greater than the emperor. And that made many of the Roman emperors extremely jittery. And that's a jitteriness that exists in many parts of our world today. There are still some totalitarian states that want the blind obedience and the unquestioning loyalty of their people. But no state has the right to make demands upon its people which violates their conscience. Whenever human authorities try to stifle a man's conviction and conscience and seek to erode his commitment to God, they have gone too far. They have stepped over the boundary. You may well remember the pressure put on the apostles of the early church. You have to stop preaching in this name. We want to hear no more talk about Jesus and the resurrection. Leave it alone. And Peter's famous reply in Acts chapter 5 and verse 29, we must obey God rather than men. How would we respond, I wonder, if placed under the kind of state pressure which forbade us to worship God as our consciences require? Well, you say, well, it's pretty easy for us to answer that question because we don't find ourselves in that situation in this country today. But it could happen in the future. And if we want more immediate application, then it is here for us. For the application is far wider than our relationship to the state and the loyalty we give to it. When a person gives himself unreservedly to God, then he will face all sorts of conflict situations. Loyalty to one's boss can clash with loyalty to be true to one's conscience and one's God? What do you do if your boss, whom you know is under a lot of pressure, asks you to tell a client that he is not in the office today? Tell a lie. And he's looking for your loyalty. What do you do if the firm for which you are working is dumping on some convenient nearby site chemical waste? Waste that could endanger lives were it to spill or leak from the container, the containers in which it was placed. The firm wants your loyalty. What do you do if your family asks you to lie to a neighbor in order to get them out of some embarrassing situation? Your family says it's looking for your loyalty. What do we do when an organization of which we are a member asks us to put our commitment to it before our commitment to God? The organization says it wants to see evidence of our loyalty. Now you see, in all of our relationships, there are boundaries to our loyalty, with one exception: our loyalty to God Himself. We owe Him more than we owe our firm, our boss, our neighbors, our friends, our family. And God, in looking for the loyalty of our lives, will never seek to violate our conscience or do us lasting harm. Now, we can try to dodge this issue. We can suggest all sorts of salving compromises to ourselves. But what in practice we are doing is pushing back the boundary of God's control. And when we do that, we are dethroning Him. We are refusing to give Him His rights. The image of God is stamped upon our lives. And so we are called upon to give to God what belongs to Him. That is all that we are. And notice, Jesus' reply has exposed the great weakness of the religious leaders' lives. For with their lips they proclaimed God to be their king, but in practice they ruled. They set the boundaries beyond which God was not allowed to pass. God was dethroned in all but name. They prayed. They went to church. They gave of the resources to God's work. But God was not given the priority in their lives which was rightly His, and which He deserved to have. Jesus' words must have fell like a sledgehammer. Give to God the things that are God's. For many years, C.S. Lewis, the famous English scholar, remained an atheist. He kept God at bay. He denied Him His rights. And then one day he says he made a disturbing discovery, and I quote, there was no region, even in the innermost depths of one's soul, which one could surround with a barbed wire fence and guard with a notice, no admittance. And that is what I wanted. Some area, however small, of which I could say to all other beings, including God, this is my business and mine alone. Jesus often turns the tables on men. When they set out to trap him, belittle him, and marginalize him, they find themselves the victims of their own traps. But Jesus can use those very traps for our good. For under the searchlight of his gaze, we see ourselves as we truly are. And we see the boundaries that we have placed around our lives. What effect these words have on the questioners of Jesus? Give to God the things that are God. Exposed, defeated, humiliated. All this group of questioners could do was slink away home. That was their immediate reaction. But it need not have been so. They could have faced up to their failure. They could have confessed their sin, but they were too proud to do that. I wonder this morning how each of us responds to these words of Jesus in the context of loyalty. Especially in conflict situations. He says, with all of the authority lying behind him, give to God the things that are God. May God, by his Spirit, seal that word in all our hearts.